In his new book, Grading for Equity, What It Is, Why It Matters, and How It Can Transform Schools and Classrooms, Joe Feldman, a former teacher, principal, and school district administrator, argues that our K-12 grading has systematically perpetrated achievement and opportunity gaps because our practices, though believed to benefit students and seemingly neutral on their face, actually enable teachers' unconscious biases to operate. If done differently, maintains Feldman, grades can be accurate, not infected with bias, and can intrinsically motivate students to learn. Joe Feldman is the CEO of Crescendo Education Group, which is based in Oakland, California, providing teacher professional development on grading and assessment practices. Again, the new book is Grading for Equity, and we welcome Joe Feldman to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me to the conversation.
At what point did you start to realize this was a problem?
Well, as you said, I've been in schools a long time in multiple roles, and it always nagged at me that you could have teachers who might be teaching the same course in adjacent classrooms. Let's say they're both teaching Algebra 1, and you could have one teacher, even though the teachers are using the same curriculum and have similar students and the same training, in one teacher's classroom you might have 10% of the students who are failing, and in the next teacher's class teaching the same course you might have 40% of the students failing. And it wouldn't have to do with anything except how the teachers chose to grade. And we know that we want students to have grades that reflect what they know, not the unique ideas about how the teachers grade. And so that got me on this path.
When it comes to that idea of equity, how do we define that? Let's have a baseline there, and then we'll get into some of the nitty-gritty.
Sure. We want the grades that students get not to reflect their education backgrounds or their environments or the color of their skin or their gender. And so what we want to have is the grading that teachers use would not take those things into account. That's the baseline for what we want equitable grading to be.
Is it safe to say that the grading system that would be equitable in School District A is not the same that it would be in School District R or T or L?
Well, interestingly, we've tried these practices in lots of different school environments. So both in high-performing elite schools like Phillips Andover, which is, you know, very few students can even dream of getting into, to schools that are serving the most disadvantaged populations. And what we're finding is that using more equitable practices benefits all students. It both decreases the inflation that lots of times happens in grading, and it also stops the deflation that often happens in grading. So we're finding that we're getting more accurate grades and more equitable grades regardless of the population.
How does it deal with, like, standardized testing? So what would explain students with identical standardized test scores often receiving different grades?
Well, I think there's a couple dynamics going on there. The first is that we know that standardized tests can be influenced by how the student is feeling that day on the test. But I think the larger issue is that we want the grades to accurately reflect what students know. And what that means is that teachers can be taught how not to include things that don't have to do with what students know. So an example is that teachers oftentimes include what's called a participation grade. So this is, you know, the student coming to the class on time or having their notebook or raising their hand. And although those things are really important, when they get included in the grade, they start to warp the accuracy of it. So it no longer represents what a student knows of the course content. It starts to collapse and combine both how the student behaves and what they know, and you start to get inaccurate grading. And what we're finding is when we use improved practices, that the grade starts to reflect what the test scores show in a tighter correlation.
Give us a sense of the history of how we got to our current grading practices and ultimately how they've evolved over time. I mean, this is something that you date back to the Industrial Revolution.
That's right. So the A through F scale and using the 0 to 100 scale and rewarding students for behavior with points all dates back to that time period where we were very interested in being efficient efficient and scientifically precise and managing our students so that they could be ready for factory work. And so embedded in our current grading are a lot of those ideas that we no longer subscribe to, ideas like we should manage students by extrinsic motivation, so giving them points for things. We know now that intrinsic motivation, students being driven because of a desire that's inside them rather than something that people give them or take away, is a much more effective motivator, particularly when it comes to critical thinking skills, which happens in our learning. The second way is that we no longer have a need to sort students, and being so efficient, we have made our schools so that we could separate the students who would work in the factories from the students who would be bosses. And nowadays, we are much more committed to having every student be able to graduate, every student be able to have any opportunity they want to pursue. So because those ideas were there at the birth of our grading system, they're still there. And so teachers often inadvertently are using practices that perpetuate inequities and those old ideas, even though we know now that those ideas are no longer valid.
And what is so concerning about this, and you write about this quite a bit, which is that so much and so many, if not all of the decisions that a school makes is based on grades.
That's right. So we know that whether students are promoted to the next grade or they participate in sports or are admitted to college or scholarships, even car insurance rates can be based on grades that students get. All these high-stakes decisions are based on the grades that we believe and hope are accurate and fair and accurately describe a student's performance. And so teachers are often stunned to learn that many of the common grading practices they use are outdated, inaccurate, and undermine student success and even increase the achievement gaps.
So let's talk about some of the changes that you would like to see. Is this basically a scrapping of our current system?
No, it's preserving the ideas that we want to be able to give accurate feedback to students on how well they're doing and report to parents or anyone else what level of achievement a student has in the course content. Instead, while we want to preserve that, we want to make it so the grade doesn't have elements in it that are subjective or invite teachers' biases or include information that warps the accuracy of the grade.
You write in the book, learning depends on mistakes, but only when there's a mechanism to review mistakes and an opportunity to correct them. How do you see that working in a revised grading system?
Right. So the traditional way that teachers work is they give a quiz over some content. Well, they teach content, and then they give a quiz over it, and then maybe another quiz, and they give a test. And they take all the scores that students got over that time and average them together, and that's the final grade that the student gets for that unit. And that's been the way that we've done it for decades and decades, and most teachers still do it that way. The problem with averaging that student's performance over time is that if the student makes mistakes in their learning, when they take the first quiz, let's say they don't do very well because they haven't learned it yet, and the second quiz they do a little better, but in the test they ace it because they've learned everything. The final grade for that student is an averaging of growth over time rather than reflecting what that student ultimately achieved. It's as if when we had runners run a race, we didn't say how well they did on the day of the race, but we also looked at averaging their time over all of their trials. And what that does is it pulls down students' grades of the students who struggle with content and rewards the students who ace it every time. And what that does is it perpetuates reinforcing of the resources that the higher performing students have had and makes it much harder for students who struggle to be successful.
You advocate giving students the opportunity to retake tests, to redo assignments. How does that work? When and why should that be applied?
So when we think about it, in the professional world, whenever we as adults are asked to show competence in some area and to take a test, we're allowed to take that test multiple times. So driver's license, you can take it multiple times and there's no penalty. Same with medical boards and the bar exam and teacher credentials and nursing exams. So we should apply that same professional expectation to our students. Logistically, that would mean that after a student takes a test, if there were opportunities for them to continue learning, to learn from the mistakes they made, the teacher would think about, well, what will the student need to do in the meantime to learn what they hadn't learned? And then they'll take a new test, whether it be the same exact test or it would be new questions or a new test format. And if the student did better on that, then that score would replace the earlier grade because, again, we wouldn't want to average their performance because it wouldn't be accurate. It would misrepresent what the student had ultimately learned.
Joe Feldman is the author of the new book, Grading for Equity, What It Is, Why It Matters, and How It Can Transform Schools and Classrooms. Of course, critics will look at this, and even skeptics will say, okay, but you don't get a second chance if you're out in the professional world. You gave some examples of where you do get second chances. But how do you counter that argument?
Yeah, well, one argument is that we're dealing with 13, 14, 12, 11, 10-year-olds where right. We actually don't want to punish them if they don't get something right the first time. And the second is that when you're really asked to think about examples in the real world or the professional world, redos happen all the time. I mean, last night I went to dinner and I got food that was not hot enough. And so I sent it back, and they got to do a redo, and they made me the food better the second time. So all of that happens in the real world, and I think that's one of the messages we want to teach students, is that if you don't get something right the first time or you want to be able to improve, you always can.
Talk to me a little bit about teachers. It seems that you say in this book that a lot of what they're doing, they don't realize they're doing.
That's right, because teachers, the irony is that as important the work is of assigning grades, the way that encapsulates the most high professional judgment of the teacher, despite that fact, teachers get no training in how to grade. They don't get any courses in graduate school. There's nothing that happens in their professional development while they're in school. And so most teachers end up replicating how they've been graded. And when they're given a chance to learn about the history and learn about the way that their current grading practices are negatively impacting a lot of their students, they realize that this is a terrible way to grade, and it's undermining their work, and they want to try something new.
You want the kid, ultimately, the student who wants to learn for the sake of learning, right? So how do you ultimately make that happen and allow that to flourish in a classroom?
Yeah, great question. So when students start in school, when they're kindergartners or first graders, they're very excited about learning. No student asks, what grade am I getting? How many points do I get? They are excited to learn. So they come to school with that. And unfortunately, around the fourth or fifth grade, teachers start introducing all the points and all the extrinsic motivation so that by the time they get to middle school and high school, everything that a student does is in service of points. And the students will even say, you know, I'm 2 points away from an A, or how can I get more points for this? Or they haggle or bargain with teachers around points. And what we're finding is that when we don't create a system of points that are essentially an extrinsic motivation system, but instead say to students, if you can do this content at this particular level, you'll be able to get a B, and at this level, we'll earn you a C. We find that students take it as an intrinsic motivation. I want to learn this material so that I can get a B. I'm not just trying to get all the points in whatever way possible. And we're finding that students are even taking more initiative to learn and asking teachers for additional work, in fact, so that they can meet the expectations of the different grades.
There are those who write about education who take it one step further and say that we should do away with grading altogether.
Yeah, there are a few folks who say that. I'm more agnostic about that. I think that it's really important that students get accurate information about the grades, and I get that, you know, all the college admissions officers don't have time to read 5,000 narrative reports about all their students. So I think it's much, as long as we have an A through F system, I'm okay with that, as long as the grades and the practices that are behind them are more accurate and fair.
Does any of this make it more difficult for the teacher?
Initially, it's a conceptual difficulty. So one of the things we talk about is that homework shouldn't be included in the student's grade. So while we still think homework should be assigned, and it's really important for a lot of students' learning, to include a student's performance on homework, it warps the accuracy of the grade again and creates more inequities for reasons we can talk about. But that idea, even though when teachers start doing that, it turns out that wonderful things start happening in the classroom, it's very difficult conceptually for a teacher to envision that I wouldn't include homework in the grade. Their fear is that no one will do it. It'll be just chaos. No students will learn. And that's really the most difficult part for them. And when they start trying the practices in very small ways and they start seeing benefits, they find that it really frees them up, not only their time, but the way they think about what happens in their classroom.
Does it have to be universal throughout the school in the sense of, can Mrs. Boucher look at some of the ideas in your book and put those into practice while Mr. Quimby down the hall would have a more an approach that is more common?
Well, already there's so much variability in how teachers grade that our stance is if we can have individual teachers grading more equitably and fair and accurately, then that's better than what we currently have. What we find is that teachers really don't get a chance to even talk to each other about how they grade. So if teachers start using practices that are having lots of benefits, it will start to spread through a school. And the differences between one teacher and the next teacher, they're already happening anyway, and so this starts to lead to more consistency.
Does it change? I mean, this goes back to a question that I asked earlier, but I guess I'm trying to get a handle on, does it change from classroom to classroom in the sense of that my class in calendar year 2018-2019 is going to be much different than the makeup of my class, say, 4 years ago? Mm-hmm. So does my grading change because the equity has changed?
Well, I think that although the students are changing, some of their needs aren't. And you'll always have a diversity of students. So let me take another example. Let's say you have some students in the class who at home have parents who aren't as available to support them, or they have more responsibilities at home. You'll always have in your classroom students who fit that profile, whether it be a quarter of the students or half or three quarters. And so if you can start using practices in your grading that don't penalize students for those characteristics, and at the same time also don't reward students who have two parents and who are available and a well-lit home and lots of resources and internet access, then you're going to get more fairness and objectivity in your grading.
I should note, and I should have made this point earlier in our conversation, but throughout the book you have student voices, kids who are telling you about what's actually happening in their classroom. You talked to a high school student, and there's a section in here about homework, and said, we have the biggest homework copier in my grade, and he has a high cumulative GPA, too. He doesn't have to worry about actually trying to figure out and do the work. He barely passes the tests, but if you get all A's on the homework assignments, you get a high grade and really don't even need to know anything. I am not as well versed in this as you are, but that seems to be a problem.
Yes, and that's really a consequence of the current way that we grade, where we reward students by everything they do. So we think as teachers that if we don't give students points for completing the homework, they won't do it. And what that does is that students can complete homework because they copied off each other, or they got help from an older sibling or a parent, or they looked up the information on the internet, or they have their tutor do it. And so there's all these different ways that students do whatever they can to complete homework. And there are other students who aren't able to complete the homework because they don't have all those resources, or it's just plain too difficult for them. And when we include those kinds of scores in a grade, we end up having the student who conceded that there are students who copy all the time and get A's. And so when we don't include how students do on homework in their grade, and only how they do on tests and other large assessments, we're able to more accurately describe what students know. And homework becomes a means to an end. Students do homework because they understand that by doing it, they'll do better on the tests, not because the teacher told them to.
All right, let's end with this. How optimistic are you?
Well, when we're talking about changing grading, we're talking about changing one of the foundations of our schools. And it is very difficult to envision how grading could be different. The hope I have is that teachers who are using these practices are finding great results. And I think if we are truly committed to increasing equity and reducing the achievement and opportunity gaps, that motivation will get us to take the leap to try something different. So I'm hopeful, although I think it's going to take a while.
Okay. I'm not sure you would convince a jury, but that's okay. We take our hope where we can get it, right?
That's right. That's right. And there's enough teachers, I think, and school leaders who are committed to this kind of work where they will take this on.
The name of the book, Grading for Equity, What It Is, Why It Matters, and How It Can Transform Schools and Classrooms. The book is published by Corwin. Joe Feldman, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Grading for Equity, What It Is, Why It Matters, and How It Can Transform Schools and Classrooms. The book is published by Corwin. Joe Feldman is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.